Shutapasuchaiva. Daneshu yat punya palam pradishtam. Atyeti tat sarvamidam viditva. Yogi parangstanam upaiti chadyam. Translation. A person who accepts the path of devotional service is not bereft of the results derived from studying the Vedas, performing sacrifices, undergoing austerities, giving charity, or pursuing philosophical and fruitive activities. Simply by performing devotional service, he attains all these, and at the end he reaches the supreme eternal abode. Purport. I won't read the whole purport, but we'll begin with the first couple of paragraphs. This verse is the summation of the 7th and 8th chapters, which particularly deal with Krishna consciousness and devotional service. One has to study the Vedas under the guidance of the spiritual master and undergo many austerities and penances while living under his care. A brahmachari has to live in the home of the spiritual master just like a servant, and he must beg alms from door to door and bring them to the spiritual master. He takes food only under the master's order, and if the master neglects to call the student for food that day, the student fasts. These are some of the Vedic principles for observing brahmacharya. After the student studies the Vedas under the master for some time, at least from age 5 to 20, he becomes a man of perfect character. Study of the Vedas is not meant for the recreation of armchair speculators, but for the formation of character. After this training, the brahmachari is allowed to enter into household life and marry. When he is a householder, he has to perform many sacrifices so that he may achieve further enlightenment. He must also give charity according to the country, time, and candidate, discriminating among charity in goodness, in passion, and in ignorance, as described in Bhagavad Gita. Then, after retiring from household life, upon accepting the order of Vanaprastha, he undergoes severe penances, living in forests, dressing with tree bark, not shaving, etc. By carrying out the orders of brahmacharya, household life, vanaprastha, and finally sannyas, one becomes elevated to the perfectional stage of life. Some of them elevated to the heavenly kingdoms, and when they become even more advanced, they are liberated in the spiritual sky, either in the impersonal Brahmajyoti or in the Vaikuntha planets or Krishna Loka. This is the path outlined by Vedic literatures. The beauty of Krishna consciousness, however, is that by one stroke, by engaging in devotional service, one can surpass all the rituals of the different orders of life. That is a very key sentence in Srila Prabhupada's purport, that by engaging in devotional service, one leapfrogs, one actually makes that advancement beyond the immediate necessities of the Vedic sacrifices, penances, and austerities. And so, if we look at this chapter as the continuation of chapter 7, and we examine it and go through it, you can see that up through chapter 7, Krishna has explained many different aspects of material life and spiritual life. And he has explained it especially in the context of this Vedic understanding of the world and the Vedic concepts of civilization and advancement. So, if we look at the different yogas that Krishna has explained in chapter 2, he explains Sankhya Yoga, chapter 3, Karma Yoga, chapter 4, Jnana Yoga, chapter 5, Karma Yoga in Krishna consciousness, as Srila Prabhupada calls it. And chapter 6, Dhyana Yoga, which is the yoga of meditation. Dhyana means meditation. Is the eightfold mystic path, which culminates in samadhi. And then Arjuna rejects these different forms of yoga as being impractical and impossible to achieve for him as an active person engaged in the material world. And so at that point, Krishna launches into what we know as chapter 7, and Krishna reveals how he can be seen even by someone who is engaging himself in looking at the material energy, even someone engaged in material activities, by seeing with transcendental knowledge. So, for example, one sees the light of the sun and the moon, and one can immediately understand that these are the energies of Krishna. One experiences the taste of water. So one can experience that action of Krishna consciousness, a form of understanding and knowing how Krishna acts within the material energy. And so this chapter 7 has this quality where we can see Krishna's action in the material realm. But with chapter 8, Krishna, he makes it more personal. Because he ends chapter 7, by explaining that he is the Supreme Lord, the governing principle of the material manifestation. He's the supreme controller of the demigods. He is the Lord of all the sacrifices and penances. And if one knows this, he says, at the time of death, one can attain me, the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So there are a lot of things in this, in the final verse of the 7th chapter, where Krishna is preparing Arjuna's understanding. So Arjuna finally, in this 8th chapter, he questions Krishna very closely. He said, well, you've told me this, that you are Brahman, you are... And so I want to know, what is Brahman? What is karma? What is Atma? What are fruit of activities? What is this material manifestation? What are the demigods? And what is the Lord of Sacrifice? How does sacrifice work? And how does the Lord of Sacrifice live within the body? So these are the questions of the first two verses of the 8th chapter. And it's a tall order, you know, it's like, what is the meaning of life, you know, right in and all its various aspects in two quick, short shlokas, two quick, short verses. And then also, prayana kale and anta kale, what happens at the time of death? And this is something that everybody is interested in one way or another, because everybody knows that that time will come. No one is exempt. There are no exemptions. And so anyone with any intelligence wants to know. There's a talk show personality. When he has his guests on his show, he has a little section where he says, tell me something I don't know. No. So this is a nice way of getting the attention of the audience. And so this is really something that nobody knows, and Krishna is going to explain it. There's a very nice story when Ambarish Prabhu first met Srila Prabhupada. As we know, Ambarish is the great grandson of Henry Ford. And so when he came in, first thing that Srila Prabhupada said, so, you are the great-grandson of Henry Ford? And Ambarish said, yes, Prabhupada. And so he said, so Prabhupada said, and where is he now? Yeah. So we all would like to know, where is he now? Where are we going to be now? And So this Krishna explains, and it's a very simple one thing about, it's interesting about verse 5, where Krishna explains, whoever at the end of his life quits his body remembering me, at once attains my nature. Of this there is no doubt. See? And what's interesting about the purport is that Prabhupada actually, I think it's the only time it happens in the purports of the Bhagavad Gita, Prabhupada quotes the whole mantra, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. And he quotes it twice in the purport of this verse, as if to emphasize that it's actually through this mantra, through the chanting of this mantra, that we will actually know at the time of death what our destination will be, that we will attain Krishna. And he also outlines the qualifications that Lord Chaitanya gives, that one should be more tolerant than the tree, devoid of all sense of false prestige, when one comes to this understanding at the time of death. So, and then in the next verse, he explains further, yam yam vapi smaran bhavam tyajatyante kalevaram tam tam evaiti konteya sada tad bhava bhavitaha. This is the key verse for understanding that whatever state of being one remembers when he quits his body, O son of Kunti, that state he will attain without fail. That is Krishna's direction. That is Krishna's prescription. And so all religions have some idea about the time of death. It is one of the key functions of any religion or any spiritual path to tell you what is going to happen at the time of death. And so the Judeo-Christian and Muslim idea is that simply if you live a good life, you'll go to heaven, and if you live a bad life, you'll go to hell. And it's very simple, it's very true, and we have no problem with this. However, sometimes the definition of what is good and what is bad is in question. But that's a whole other class, and we won't go there just yet because we're dealing with the 8th chapter, with Krishna's prescription of what is good and what is bad. And this purport for verse 6 also ends with Srila Prabhupada quoting the Maha Mantra in full. I actually looked it up just was curious, because there are 8 purports in the Bhagavad Gita by Srila Prabhupada where he quotes the mantra in full, and 5 of them are in this chapter. So it's a nice little factoid. But so Krishna continues that what he considers to be good, he says that whatever your prescribed duty is, and Arjuna's was fighting, so he says, Mamanusmara yudhyacha, that you fight and you remember me at the same time. Tasmat sarveshu kaleshu, that you should always think of me, and whatever your prescribed duties, you should remember me at the same time. And further, in the next verse, he focuses, he says, Abhyasa yoga yuktena. Yoga means this linking up with Krishna, and yuktena, to be always linked in this way. Yoga yuktena. Chaitasa. Chaita, this word chaita means, it comes from the word chit. It means the knowledge that one has, the understanding of self that one has. So that chaitasa nanyagamina also, is without being deviated. Without being deviated, one should remember Krishna in this way. And paramam purusham divyam. That's what you achieve. Partanu chintayam. That's what you, Arjuna, Partha, will achieve is paramam, the supreme, purusham, personality, divyam, transcendental, the supreme transcendental personality. It's interesting that at the beginning of the chapter, Arjuna addresses Krishna as Purushottama. So this word Purusha means the person, and Uttama means the supreme, the transcendental, the, as it were, above and beyond person that Krishna is. So this is emphasized also by Krishna in this eighth verse, Paramam Purusham Divya Yati Partano Chintaya. And then the next verse, chapter 9, is one of the most interesting because in it, Krishna explains how you meditate on Krishna, what you should be thinking about Krishna when you meditate on Krishna. Because up till now, meditation has been given in the same way as the impersonal. You could up to the end of chapter 6, there's not really a specific way in which to meditate on Krishna is given. So this ninth verse is very interesting. Kim Puranam Anushasitaram Anoranayam Samanusmaretya Sarvasya Dhataram Achintya Rupam Aditya Varnang Tamasa Parastat. So the first word, Kavi, Krishna says you should think of me as Kavi, Kavim. That means that as a wise as the wisest person. Sometimes we use the word Kavi to mean poet, but in this instance, in the purport, Srila Prabhupada explains that Kavi is someone who understands past, present, and future. So if you know past, present, and future, in a sense, what is your presence? You know, the Buddhists have this thing, be here now. You should always be in the present. For someone who knows past, present, and future, so he is always in the present because he is understanding where he's coming from and where he's going to. So that kind of meditation is already there. It is already part of this word Kavi that Krishna explains. And then Puranam, that Krishna is the oldest, simply because Krishna explains that before the creation, I was existing. So he must be the oldest. So we, Kaving Puranam, Anushasitaram, Shasi, this Shastra, we get the word Shastra meaning controlling. Anushasitaram, that Anu means always, that Krishna is always controlling everything. That is a concept that is I'll get to that later on. But that is the main thing, that Krishna is always the controller. Anor Aniyangsam. Anor Aniyangsam means he's smaller than the smallest. So Srila Prabhupada, sometimes he challenged that the modern technologies, you can build a huge Boeing 747 or whatever, but you cannot build a mosquito. Actually, they're trying. The drone technology, you know, they have that now, drone technology, where they're creating these machines flying in the sky and they send back information or they do things that they're supposed to do. So they would love to have a drone that is as small as a mosquito that could fly around and spy on everybody. You know, that's their idea of advancement. But Krishna, he's able to do that without any material arrangement, just from within the soul. There is the super soul residing. And so that Anior Aniyangsam, that's the explanation for these two words of verse 9. So then he says, Anusmared, Anu means continually, smared, remembering, continually remembering me in this way. Sarvasya Dhataram. Sarvasya means everything. And of everything, Dhataram, I am maintaining, I'm holding up, lifting. We say Giri Vara Dhari. Dhari, that means Krishna is lifting Govardhan Hill. So Sarvasya Dhataram, he's lifting everything. So Srila Prabhupada often gave that description that the planets are floating in space and Krishna is holding them up in space. So the scientists, they're understanding that their theories of gravity are impractical and inadequate to explain. So they're simply calling it dark matter. Dark matter is somehow in the universe somewhere and is keeping everything from flying apart. And it's helping gravity to keep everything together. That's an explanation. But Krishna explains, yes, this is my energy. And then Krishna says, achintya rupam. That's the next thing. Inconceivable form. Krishna has an inconceivable form. We can see Krishna as a little boy, and he's stealing the butter, and he's playing with the monkeys, feeding the monkeys, and he's doing all kinds of little mischievous things. And yet at the same time, he is doing all these other things. He is maintaining, he is the supreme controller, he is all these things. But at the same time, achintya rupam, he has an inconceivable form. And it's described in Brahma Samhita, that wonderful verse, premanjana churita bhakti vilochanena santasadaiva hridayeshu vilokayanti yang shyama sundaram achintya guna svarupam. That achintya word is there, and svarupam, rupam, that Krishna's inconceivable form is there. Govindam adi purusham tamaham bhajami. So, and then in the last line of this text 9, aditya varnam. What is aditya varnam? Aditya varnam means the sun, luminous like the sun. Aditya varnam. So Krishna is luminous like the sun. Not sure exactly how to give an analogy to present that at this time, but let's just say that this is a self-evident feature of Krishna's achintya rupam. And tamasa parastat. Tamasa means this material energy, this mode of ignorance that we are in this material world. Parastat, always transcendental. Para and stat means superior situation. He always has a superior situation as regards the tamas of this material world, tamasa parastat. So that's that is what we are advised by Krishna, how to meditate on him when we're thinking of Krishna. So this is Krishna consciousness, that we're always thinking of Krishna. And one of the things in the purport for this 28th verse is that we understand and we learn these truths about Krishna consciousness. We learn the Bhagavad Gita in the association of devotees, that we learn it from devotees and we associate with devotees and we discuss these topics with each other. So text 14, Prabhupada gives an explanation of the role of a pure devotee. So I'll read it a little bit. It says, the special qualification of a pure devotee is that he's always thinking of Krishna without deviation and without considering the time or place. There should be no impediments. He should be able to carry out his service anywhere and at any time. Some say that the devotee should stay and live in holy places like Vrindavan or some holy town where the Lord lived. But a pure devotee can live anywhere and create the atmosphere of Vrindavan by his devotional service. And it was Sri Advaita who told Lord Chaitanya, wherever you are, O Lord, there is Vrindavan. So this is a wonderful meditation, a wonderful example given by Srila Prabhupada, who personally practiced this realization of Krishna consciousness, that anywhere where he was became a Krishna conscious place, became a holy place, became somewhere where people could take advantage and become Krishna conscious themselves. And this, interestingly enough, is also one of the purports that ends with the full Maha Mantra explained by Srila Prabhupada. So most of the rest of the chapter is sort of interesting, but Krishna explaining Abrahma Bhuvanaloka Punararti Norjuna Mamu Petya Tu Konteya Punarjanmana Vidyate, that from the highest planet in this material universe down to the lowest, all are places of misery. They are Dukalayama Shashvatam. They're always temporary, and they're always full of miseries. And one should try to get out. Now, there was a nice article in the latest Back to Godhead magazine that always said, why is Krishna consciousness so pessimistic, you know? And this is a superficial reading of what devotees actually know about Krishna consciousness. It's a superficial understanding because, yes, we are pessimistic about the material energy and the material world, but we're very optimistic about Krishna consciousness and the goal of devotees and the ultimate end of devotees. This is our optimism that, you know, Krishna says, Punarjanmana vidyate, we will not know birth, death, old age, and disease again if we become Krishna conscious, and we never return. Yangatvanani vartante. You know. So, then Krishna also explains the age of Lord Brahma, Sahasra Yuga Paryantam, Ahariyad Brahmano Vidu. And he also explains Bhutva Bhutva Pralayate, that at Brahma's night, all these things dissolve and they're destroyed. That is the nature of the material world. This is the reality. It's not pessimism. It's reality. And then you get another chance. When Brahma revives again from his sleep, then again, the material energy, this is reconstituted. And the living entities, they go back in, and they begin over again. So it is not exactly pessimistic. And then Krishna gives the examples of how the passing away from this material world. This is about all we have time for the rest of the chapter. And it's kind of mysterious what it actually means. Those who know the Supreme Brahman, they attain the Supreme by passing away from the world during the influence of the fiery God in the light at an auspicious moment during the day, during the fortnight of the waxing moon, or during the 6 months when the sun travels in the north. And then the mystic who passes his way during the smoke, the night, the fortnight of the waning moon, or the 6 month when the sun passes to the south, reaches the moon planet, and then, but again, comes back. So that's one of the examples that we have is in Srimad Bhagavatam, where there are actually two examples, because I was interested in this because of the difference in the way they're described in the Srimad Bhagavatam. And one is the passing away of Maharaj Yudhishthira, how he left the planet, and the other is the passing away of Bhishmadev. And they're two very different explanations of what they did in order to go back home, back to Godhead. So it's described that Maharaj Yudhishthira, after being the emperor of the world, he at once relinquished all his trappings, all his garments and belts and ornaments of the royal order, all this wonderful gear, as they say, and became completely disinterested and unattached to everything. And then it describes he amalgamated all the sense organs into the mind, and then the mind into prana, into the life airs, life into breathing, his total existence into the embodiment of the five elements, and his body into death. Then, as pure self, He became free from the material conception of life. And that's a very technical, and thus annihilating the gross body of the five elements into the three qualitative modes of material nature, he merged them into one nescience and then absorbed that nescience in the self, Brahman, which is inexhaustible in all circumstances. And then it was really curious. After that, there's more. Wait, there's more. After that, Maharaj Yudhishthira dressed himself in torn clothing, gave up eating all solid foods, voluntarily became dumb, let his hair hang loose, and this combined to make him look like an urchin or a madman. And he didn't depend on his brothers for anything. And like a deaf man, he heard nothing, and he started toward the north, treading the path of his forefathers, to devote himself completely to thought of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And he lived that way wherever he went. That is the description of Maharaj Yudhishthira. Now we come to the description of the passing of Bhishma Dev, and it's very enlightening, because Bhishma Dev was empowered by being able to leave his body at will. He could choose the time of his passing. And so he had, after the battle of Kurukshetra, laid down on the bed of arrows. All these arrows were sticking in his body, but he was able to maintain and remain alive. Even it said that, you know, you couldn't fit a finger between all the arrows that were piercing him. This is the description. And so it's described that thereupon, this is 1930, that man who spoke on different subjects with thousands of meanings and who fought on thousands of battlefields and protected thousands of men stopped speaking and, being completely freed from all bondage, withdrew his mind from everything and fixed his wide open eyes on the Supreme Original Personality of Godhead, Sri Krishna, who stood before him four-handed, dressed in yellow garments that glittered and shined. Now, in the purport, actually, Srila Prabhupada quotes the verse 5 through 10 of this chapter of Bhagavad Gita, chapter 8. And then description of Bhishma's passing: by pure meditation, looking at Lord Sri Krishna, Bhishma Dev at once was freed from all material inauspiciousness and was relieved of all bodily pains caused by the arrow wounds. Thus, all external activities of his senses at once stopped, and he prayed transcendentally to the controller of all living beings while quitting his body. And Bhishma Dev then explains all the ways in which he remembers Krishna. And he says that on the battlefield, the flowing hair of Lord Krishna turned ashen due to the dust raised by the hoofs of the horses. And because of Krishna's labors driving the chariot of Arjuna, beads of sweat wetted his face. All these decorations, intensified by wounds dealt by my sharp arrows, were enjoyed by Krishna. Let my mind thus go to Sri Krishna. In obedience to the command of his friend, Lord Sri Krishna entered the arena of the battlefield of Kurukshetra between the soldiers of Arjuna and Duryodhana, and while there, Krishna shortened the lifespans of the opposite party by his merciful glance. This was done simply by looking at the enemy. And let my mind be fixed upon that, Krishna. And when Arjuna was seemingly polluted by ignorance upon observing the scene on the battlefield, the Lord eradicated his ignorance by delivering transcendental knowledge. May his lotus feet remain the object of my attraction. Fulfilling my vow and sacrificing his own promise, Krishna got down from his chariot, took up its wheel and ran towards me, just like a lion goes to kill an elephant. He even dropped his outer garment on the way. May he, Lord Krishna, who awards salvation, be my ultimate destination. On the battlefield, he charged me, as if angry because of the wounds dealt by my sharp arrows. His shield was scattered, and his body was smeared with blood due to the wounds. At the moment of death, let my attraction be to Sri Krishna, the personality of Godhead. I concentrate my mind upon the chariot driver of Arjuna, who stood with a whip in his right hand and a bridle rope in his left, who was very careful to give protection to Arjuna's chariot by all means. Those who saw him on the battlefield of Kurukshetra attained their original forms after death. Let my mind be fixed upon Lord Sri Krishna, whose motions and smiles of love attracted the damsels of Rajadham, the gopis. The damsels imitated the characteristic movements of the Lord after his disappearance from the Rasa dance. At the Rajasuya, performed by Maharaj Yudhishthira, there was the greatest assembly of elite men of the world, royal and learned orders. In that great assembly, Lord Sri Krishna was worshipped by one and all as the most exalted personality of Godhead. This happened during my presence, and I remembered this incident in order to keep my mind upon the Lord. Now I can meditate with full concentration upon that one Lord Sri Krishna now present before me, because now I have transcended the misconceptions of duality in regard to his presence in everyone's heart, even in the hearts of the mental speculators. He is in everyone's heart. The sun may be perceived differently, but the sun is one. Suta Goswami said, thus Bhishmadev merged himself into the super soul, Lord Sri Krishna, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, with his mind, speech, sight, and actions. And thus he became silent and his breathing stopped. So that's what we have for today. Thank you very much. Are there any questions or comments that... does someone have the thing? Can someone take it around? Oh, yes. All right, Prabhu.
Hare Krishna, Prabhu.
Hare Krishna.
I have four true or false questions.
Okay.
Question number one. Perfection needs practice. Is that true or false?
Well, Krishna's perfection doesn't need any practice. Krishna is automatically perfect. So in that sense, false. For those in the material, in the contamination of material existence, yes, practice is necessary, true.
At the time of death, thinking of Krishna perfectly needs practice. Is that true or false?
For those in the material realm, yeah. For those who are contaminated by, who have been contaminated by material existence, yes. That is actually explained in one of the purports. Actually, it was further on in the purport to chapter 28. It says here, no one can perfectly. One has to have a little faith when one searches. Anyway, it's in one of the purports of this chapter, because I know I saw that specifically. It's one of the. Let me just get the exact quote. Remembrance of Krishna is not possible for the impure soul who has not practiced Krishna consciousness in devotional service. That is a direct quote from one of the purports. I noted it as one of the points that kind of Srila Prabhupada reveals in this chapter. There are a bunch of different points that are there, yes. So,
third question.
Yeah.
In order for getting perfection of thinking of Krishna gives difficulties and dangers to their devotees so that they can get perfect in their thinking for the final destination. Is that true or false?
It was certainly true of the Pandavas in a way. Krishna does, but Krishna also reciprocates according to the desire of the devotee. So if we have desire, then Krishna will reciprocate that desire.
My understanding is that Krishna gives difficulties and dangers for his devotees so that they can practice thinking of him, so that at the end they can definitely think of him.
That's the prayer of Queen Kunti, actually, that let my mind flow towards Krishna just as the Ganges flows down to the sea. But she also says, oh, put us into these difficulties that we went through. We want to be put into these difficulties so that we always have to take shelter of you. We always have to think of you.
So the difficulties given to the devotees are really a blessing.
That's the understanding. Although in our current situation, one might not appreciate that.
The last question I have,
yes,
is Krishna's devotees have a programmed death. That means they will die during certain times, as you mentioned in your class. Is that true or false?
That is up to Krishna, because Krishna can make an exception. It's just like you cannot get a doctorate degree without a lot of study at a university and so on. But sometimes the universities, they'll make an exception and they'll give an honorary degree. And so that person will be honored. And so in the same way, Krishna is not bound by the conventions, by any conventions. And so Krishna can make an exception.
My understanding is about 99% of the Vaishnavas, if you want, you can refer back, who have passed away or passed away during those right times, where they can reach the Goloka. Thank you.
That is probable, yes. So there's one lady that after. So first Dharmatma, yes, Raga.
Hare Krishna, thanks for that great class. Prabhu, I'm just wondering, so you were looking for a way to describe Krishna's luminosity?
Oh, that's right,
at
yes.
one point, so I was just remembering that Prabhupada described the bright and shiny faces of the devotees.
<That's>
it seemed
right.
a little similar.
Yes.
And the question I had was, basically, I was... in my youth, I was quite attracted to the Tibetan Book of the Dead.
Uh-huh.
You know, some of the members of my family were reading things like that. So this is, in one sense, quite elementary in comparison to Krishna consciousness, those kind of books and writings.
I wouldn't say elementary in the sense that it's very difficult to read, and the translations don't seem to be adequate. And the basic problem is that the culture is now lost. And when the culture is lost, the accompanying understandings that go with such a thing as the Tibetan Book of the Dead become very, very difficult to understand. It's just like I can remember before becoming a devotee, I had heard of the Bhagavad Gita, and I actually saw a little kind of pickpocket edition, you know, in somebody's house, and I thought, well, let me have a look at this, you know, and I'll try to find out what the Bhagavad Gita is about. And I could not understand a word. It was just completely foreign. I didn't understand what they were trying to tell, what the book was trying to tell, because there was no surrounding, there was no context, and there was no devotee to actually explain these things to me. So these kinds of esoteric teachings of Buddhism, they're very, very difficult.
So, thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you.
You gave the reference of the life of Maharaj Yudhisthira. So
yes.
My question is, what... why was that necessary when Maharaj Yudhisthira's whole life he spent with Krishna? So what was the purpose of his getting to that mood towards the end of his life when his entire life was spent with the Supreme Lord?
Well, I have read a translation of Mahabharata, not in full, it's a summarized version of Mahabharata and translated into English. And Maharaj Yudhisthira had tremendous doubts possibly because as the son of Lord Yamaraj, he was very involved in the ethics of why are we pursuing the kingdom? Why are we killing all these people in order to become the royal family, in order to become the royal, to establish ourselves as the emperor of the earth? So he had tremendous conversations, for example, with Bhishma Dev at the end, where they discussed what was his correct, what way he should rule the earth, and why he should rule the earth, how he was had been, as it were, delegated by Krishna to rule the earth as emperor. And so he had tremendous sensitivity and tremendous compassion. And so, in that sense, as a character in the story, he becomes that the embodiment of those doubts and that kind of thing. So that was Yudhishthira's role. And therefore, he had to take what you might call his example was given of the way he had to kind of get into what the Dhyana Yoga described by Krishna in the sixth chapter of Bhagavad Gita. He had to sort of enter into that kind of mode in order to release himself from these attachments that he had to being the emperor of the world and the doubts that he had about his own situation. So he's a very complex character in that way. For example, Bhima, his brother, who is the embodiment of strength, is a very straightforward kind of personality, you know, in the mode of passion, and he's always doing, and he's always there for it, you know. But Yudhishthira is not always there for it, and because he's more involved in the ethics and the morality of what he is doing. So this is kind of his role, as it were, in the discussions of the Mahabharata and the dialogues that take place within the Mahabharata. So that's that answers the question. Yes, is there?
So is there a type of memory that's in the subtle body that is beyond the gross body? And the reason I ask this question is because, at least as the gross body is concerned, our memory is related to the quality of the brain. Like, for example, if the brain gets deteriorated either by old age or by an accident, you know, we develop either Alzheimer's or their medical condition as short-term memory loss or long-term memory loss. Mm-hmm. How can we yet still remember Krishna at the time of death if, you know, let's say, for example, my whole life I've been a good devotee, chanting 16 rounds, following the principles, but then I get in a really bad car accident and I get hit in the head and my brain gets damaged and I suffer memory loss because that part of the brain where we store the memory is damaged. Can I still remember Krishna in a way, as like in my subtle body or something like that?
Well, these are the questions. These are what you might call unusual circumstances. This is not the normal. But we know that Krishna promises that if one becomes my devotee, he is never vanquished. That's in the ninth chapter of Bhagavad Gita. So there may be some brain damage. I mean, Srila Prabhupada's physical condition at the time when he passed was indescribable. The doctors said that this man must be undergoing excruciating pain. And yet, Srila Prabhupada hardly manifested at all that he was undergoing this kind of tribulation. So in the same way, whatever the brain thing, I don't know. I heard one, well, better not to give anecdotal evidence. But basically, yes, the subtle body is there, and Krishna, through the supersoul, through within the heart of the living entity, knows what is happening. And because of the reciprocation, that Krishna promises that my devotee is never vanquished. Krishna will make the arrangement at the end. That we have faith. And sometimes faith is required. This is, we're not simply logicians. We actually want to encourage and want to develop our faith in Krishna, because we know it will be tested, and hopefully that we will be able to remember Krishna when the time comes.
There are a few exceptions where devotees remember the past life, like for example the devotee who got attached to a deer at the time of death and then he became a deer.
Right.
And he remembered his past life and he started making austerity, eating dry leaves. So
yes.
The physical brain from his past life wasn't there anymore. Now he has the brain of a deer, but yet
yes,
he still remembers
it, that
his past
that
life.
Is described that the subtle body, at the time of death, the subtle body, if one is not completely pure, and if one is pure, the subtle body is in a sense disintegrates, and instead of having a false ego, we now have a real ego, which then joins with Krishna in the spiritual world. So we have the real ego, as opposed to the false ego. But for those for the conditioned souls who are still in the realm of material contamination, so therefore their subtle body will go to wherever, whatever desires that they still have for material enjoyment. So that's the difference. So yes, the subtle body we understand will transit to the next life. And those memories, sometimes people will remember the past lives, but mostly they don't.
Thank you, Prabhu.
Thank you. That's a very good question. Thank you. So that is all. Thank you very much. Hare Krishna.